This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Did you know HGVs have four zones of limited vision around them? If you're in one of these areas, you may not be seen by the driver. These four limited vision zones are in front, behind, and at both sides of the HGV. So when you're driving around a HGV, don't linger around them. Because they may not notice you're there. Know the HGV zones. National Highways.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. A group called AfriForum has been at the center of the recent row between South Africa and President Trump of the US over Pretoria's Land Reform Act. Who are they? Who do they represent? And what's their philosophy?
They're not a political party. You can't vote for them. It's a private group. They claim to have about 2 million members. They fund themselves through membership, but they also have many, many businesses.
And we'll hear from Egyptian fencer Nada Hafez, who competed at the last Olympics in Paris while 7 months pregnant.
So I'm so proud of what I did because it's different and it's one of the best results in the female Egyptian Olympians. I'm a competitive person. So when it comes to the Olympics, I was thinking about my baby, that I want to be the Olympian and my baby to be an Olympian. So yeah, my baby motivated me for this.
It's Friday, February 14th. First, we go to Sierra Leone. The Sierra Leonean coastline is approximately 480 kilometers long, and it boasts rich marine biodiversity and fish, including snapper, grouper, barracuda, tuna, and shrimp. As you can imagine, this means that fishing is a crucial industry for local livelihoods. But in recent years, this abundance has been steeply reduced due to overfishing and rogue, unregulated fishing practices, including industrial trawlers, often foreign-owned, who also operate in its waters. So the country's Ministry of Fisheries and Marine Resources decided to impose a mandatory one-month fishing ban in February for all artisanal fishermen in order to allow restoration of marine life. Question is that the best solution for the fishmongers? The president of the Sierra Leone Artisanal Fishermen's Union, Thomas Ture, does not think so.
It has affected the fishers greatly because mostly the fishermen just depend on this fishing from the sea to the wharf, from the wharf to the market. And it's also affected the other sector, the women who are fishmongers. It's affected them greatly. They've just eaten all of what they were having before because for the past 3 months there was no better fishing. So by closing again, it's added to the poverty more and more. Our school children are suffering now, whereas the parents are suffering to feed.
The reason why the government did it, they say it's because in recent times the stocks of fish have been declining in Sierra Leone. If you look at the last few years, how would you say about your ability to fish, and did the decline affect your trade and livelihood?
It is true that the fishing population is dwindling, is coming down, because my union stood firm to oppose this bad method of fishing, but there was no political will. When this present government come now, they want to stop it automatically. That is why we are having crisis now. Though not physical crisis, but socially, economically, the crisis is too much to our people. The fish is going down. The stock is going down. We have 647 landing sites in Sierra Leone, starting from the border of Guinea, which is Kiragba, out to Sulima, the south. Before, the fishers go 30 liters of oil. They bring lots of fish. Today, they are going pumping over nearly 150 liters, coming back without no fish. So I think that is why the government decided to do it, that they close the sea for a month. But it is a detriment for the fact that they did it for the whole of the country. For us, we should have done it by sectors. It would have been better. But for the whole country now, to stand still on fishing, that is the most disadvantaged part of it.
So when this ban was implemented, the ministry said those affected would be given money and rice to sustain themselves. Has that been the case?
No rice. It was just a camouflage. Not even all of them got it. They returned back with the money. Some of the fishers have migrated to Guinea because they could not stand the problem of sitting here watching their nets, watching their children languishing. Or in Guinea there, they can do something to send for their people here in Sierra Leone.
So for the money that the government is giving the fishermen, how much can it buy?
That cannot even buy a half bag of rice. Those who are lucky to have it. And we have here, according to the government data, we have 12,000 fishing boats. My own registration 10 years back, we have 75,000 fishermen. We tell the population of the whole fishing sector is about over nearly 4 million. We have 7 coastal districts. How can you just give 500 liters to a fisher when the bag of rice is about a million?
So have you been speaking to the government representatives to find out or to tell them that what they're providing is simply not enough?
We don't need to even talk to government about that. 500 liters is not enough in Sierra Leone for 5 days even. Because you have to buy rice, you have to buy oil, you have to buy fish, you have to buy pepper. So that's why we don't need to talk to them. They quite well know the standard of living.
So talk to us about some of the practices that you believe have contributed to the decline in the populations of fish.
One of the bad methods of fishing is channel fishing. They go right into the creeks wherein the fish are spawning. They capture the young ones and even the eggs. So this has been a decline in the fishing population. Two, some methods are not regulated in this country. People come from neighboring countries to come and poach, Senegal and Guinea. They bring in wrong method of fishing here. Some of our methods that are regulated is better.
So, Thomas, there have been claims that some of your members may be using some of those bad methods of fishing that you've described for us. What's your response to that?
That is quite correct. They're using them. That is why our union is poor, because we stood against that for them not to use it. As a union, we've done our level best. Since 2001, 2004, we started advocating that these type of nets are very bad.
I would like you to give us some solutions. How do you think this whole situation of the declining stocks of fish can be solved?
Number one, they should finance us so that we go on with projects. Two, they should enforce the law by going down to the wharves, check the regulation, the size of the meshes. They should empower us. We check the nets. If that is done, 75% of these nets will be destroyed in Sierra Leone.
All right. Thank you, Thomas, for making the time.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thomas Ture, the president of the Sierra Leone Artisanal Fishermen's Union. I spoke with the Minister of Fisheries and Marine Resources, Princess Dugba, who defends this move as the best way to replenish marine stocks.
We decided to close the waters after we've had scientific research to show that during the month of February, that's the time that you have the fish going out to lay their eggs. And because of the bad fishing methods that we have amongst the fisher folks, we thought that it would be better for us to institute closed season in the month of February. Already, we are closing season for industrial, and that's in April. They have been doing this since 2019, so it's something they are used to. But we haven't done that for the artisanals. And most of our counterparts, they do close season, like Guinea. Guinea close season, Ghana does, and other countries. So we thought it fits that. Since our waters are not monitored properly, it would be better for us to institute a fishery management plan so that the fish will grow and be able to swim into the deep so that you can get the trawlers to catch them. And the government knows that for you to take away somebody's livelihood, you need to find an alternative way where, you know, they can survive. So what we did was to give cash compensation to the fishmongers and the fisher folks, and also to give rice, which is our staple food. And then we're also instituting training through other donor partners that will be doing training for the fisher folks. And we have the health on wheels. They are willing for us to get the hospital on wheels during this period to go out and be able to check the health status of our fisher folks.
So one of the other concerns is that not everyone adheres to this ban. Could you tell us if you're able to monitor and ensure that both the foreign vessels And some of the fishermen from within the country are actually doing what you want them to do and not going out there and fishing.
There is an adherence because we did collaborate with the Navy. So the Navy are going out there. They are doing their patrols every day. And then we have the community patrol as well that goes out. We have the consortium. They have boats. They go out to monitor. We have the marine police. They are also doing the monitoring. So there are lots of people out there doing the monitoring. And what people don't know is, or some people misunderstand, that the closure of the sea is for the artisanal. It's not for the industrial. So the industrial, they are still trawling.
The artisanal, though, seem to claim, again, from the interview we spoke to the president of their union, and they said that during this time, poachers from countries like Guinea and Senegal are taking advantage of the ban and crossing over and fishing in Sierra Leonean waters. Do you know anything about that?
No, there are no reports, as I said. They are monitoring the waters. I haven't been told that there are poachers out there. So if we get those complaints, definitely we'll put things in place.
But going back to the amount of money that you are compensating the fishermen during this period of time, could you clarify how much it is and why, in your opinion, you feel it's enough?
If you look at the cost of rice, rice is about 800,000 leons. And then somebody gives you something more than about 500,000. So even if you're spending, I don't know how much you spend a day, but me being a mother and somebody who cooks, that should be able to help you out. And if you add something just minimal on top of it, you'll be able to survive throughout the month. So the rice and the cash given really, I think, is a substantial amount because we give 500,000 leons cash and then a bag of rice, which will be also given to the fisher folks.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if you've been speaking to this union because they say it's not enough and you are saying it's enough.
That's a compensation. It's not like we are paying them off. Because that's why we really sensitize them to say that, you know, you need to be able to preserve your fish so that you can sell during that time and have money to be able to get whatever you want to get during those period.
Could you explain to us how this money is being given to them? Because some have claimed that it's not gotten to them.
What we did was really we sat down in the office and we divided ourselves into group and we divided the country into sections. So we went out to verify and we verified every name. And those that have paid their license for 2024, getting into 2025, we're supposed to have a stipend. So if you don't pay your license, because that's what is happening, you have lots of canoes out there, but they are not registered. They don't pay license. And they know that they are supposed to pay license. They're supposed to pay a license of from 1 million to 1,500,000, which is really, it's a small money for the whole year. But most of them, they don't pay license. So even though we were telling them over and over that you should be paying your license for the government to be able to give you what you are asking for, most it falls on deaf ears.
All right. Minister, thank you so much for your time and for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sierra Leone's Minister of Fisheries and Marine Resources, Princess Dugba. A South African lobby group that claims to promote the interests of white Afrikaners has come under fire and been accused of being reckless and causing trouble for the country. Members of the group, which is called AfriForum, travel to the United States to denounce South Africa's new land expropriation law. The act, which was signed by President Cyril Ramaphosa last month, allows the government, in extreme cases, to seize private land without compensation. The legislation is partly aimed at redressing the gaping land inequalities that persist more than three decades after the end of apartheid. And if you'd like to find out more about the land reform policy, listen back to our episode of the 4th of February. But back to AfriForum and the activities in the US, where they seemingly portrayed the Expropriation Act to American media and political circles as part of a wider onslaught by President Ramaphosa against Afrikaners. And it's this characterization of the law that many people believe contributed to the US president's decision to cut financial aid to South Africa. This is what President Trump told reporters during an impromptu press conference earlier this month.
Terrible things are happening in South Africa. That's under investigation right now. We'll make a determination. And until such time as we find out what South Africa is doing, they're taking away land, they're confiscating land, and actually they're doing things that are perhaps far worse than that.
U.S. President Donald Trump speaking to reporters on the tarmac of a military airbase outside Washington, D.C. earlier this month. In South Africa, President Ramaphosa speaking in Parliament was forthright in his response to America's tough stance.
We will not be deterred. We are, as South Africans, a resilient people, and we will not be bullied.
South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa. On Monday, MK, the party of South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, filed a treason complaint against AfriForum, accusing the group of betraying the country. Its leader in parliament, John Shlope, read a statement outside Cape Town Central Police Station.
The MK party vehemently condemns the treasonous actions of AfriForum, which has deliberately lobbied foreign powers to act against the sovereignty and economic interests of South Africa. Their betrayal is nothing less than an act of economic sabotage, a direct assault on our nation's independence, and a dangerous attempt to undermine the will of our people.
That was the MK's leader in Parliament, John Shlope. The AfriForum leadership called the treason accusation against them absurd and insist that they love the country. They say that they are not interested in moving to the United States, despite the Trump administration stating they would welcome Afrikaners as refugees. All this led to a flurry of internet searches on who are AfriForum. So to shed light on the group and to help us understand just how much influence they have, I turned to South African journalist and author Max Dupriya.
Let me give us a short background. During the 80s, the white right wing was quite sidelined because most Afrikaners followed F.W. de Klerk and then made a peace with Nelson Mandela, and we got to 1994. So most Afrikaners were very happy with Nelson Mandela and bought into the whole Rainbow Nation thing. But then a few things started going wrong. Thabo Mbeki took over and went from reconciliation to transformation. And then some of these old right-wing people came with a whole new philosophy of Afrikaner victimhood. And they started talking not like the old crude right-wing, but they'd start talking international language about minority groups and the UN Charter and stuff like that. And they formed this company called AfriForum. It's part of a movement called Solidarity Movement, which is also a trade union, and built an Afrikaner university and built a technical university. They started getting involved in security groups and neighborhoods and on farms. And very impressive what they did. But they rely on membership. So you have to pay 50 rand to 150 rand a month to be a member. And the way they do that is with fear and paranoia. They sell white victimhood. And they say, if you don't join us, the black government will take away your schools and will take your farms. And so gradually the whole new white victimhood started. And I think, you know, deep psychological things happening here. White people think they are special. And here they've lost all power, and it's a delayed pain. I am an Afrikaner myself. I am not a victim. I don't feel threatened. I feel totally at home in open democracy that we live in. I'm grateful for the freedom that I'm given, that my culture can blossom, because the Afrikaner culture and Afrikaner's material well-being is a lot better off now than in 1994. They are among the top 2% privileged people in the country, but they don't call the shots.
So how representative would you say they are of South Africa's Afrikaner community? Yourself, you've told us that you do not quite agree or associate or identify with the philosophy that they are putting out there.
No, not at all. How popular are they? We don't know, because they're not a political party. You can't vote for them. It's a private group. They claim to have about 2 million members. But a lot of those people, some of the people I know, have joined AfriForum for those kind of private security businesses and so on. And they don't necessarily buy into this new Afrikaner white nationalism.
And do we have an idea how AfriForum is funded?
Oh, they are the wealthiest NGO in the Southern Hemisphere. They fund themselves through membership, but they also have many, many businesses. They sell insurance, they sell banking, they sell financial services, funeral policies. So they are funded by members and by the business they do with those members.
Some people have argued that they are a white nationalist group. I think you've alluded to that as well. But they refer to themselves and are sometimes referred to as a civil rights organization. Which one of those do you think is a more of a fair description from where you sit?
Yeah, I've been fighting against that with the local media, saying, stop referring to AfriForum as a civil rights movement. It's an Afrikaner rights movement. And they are privileged. There's not a single event or action that they can point to that they are being persecuted. Their land has not been taken away. Not a single square inch of land had been expropriated of white Afrikaners since 1994. Nothing. Now, farm murders, the killing of white farmers on farms is a reality, and it's dangerous, and it's ugly, and it's nasty, but it's not political. Every inch of information and research we have, it's purely opportunistic crime. But the primordial fear is, the blacks are coming to get us. They first want to kill us, drive us off our land. And AfriForum amplifies that.
You said that in actual sense, they're actually not being persecuted in South Africa, and the incidents where white farmers have been killed were not political. But these words of the EFF's leader, Julius Malema, have been circulating on social media, you know, and it's a song that translates to kill the Boer. What about that? Because that seems to be sort of informing the argument at this moment.
Yes. I went to Malema and I said, you know me, why do you want to cut my throat? And he said, it's metaphorical. We don't want to kill you, we want to kill whiteness. And I kept on saying to him, but you are fanning the flames of paranoia among the white people and the Afrikaners. And he says, well, he doesn't care about that. So, yeah, I think this kind of populist racial rhetoric didn't help at all, and it furthered the cause of the AfriForum people.
So what do you make of the recent lobbying efforts in the U.S. and, you know, trying to garner the support of President Trump, specifically against President Ramaphosa's land reform policy?
I think it is unpatriotic. I think it is reckless. And I think we're going to pay a very serious price as South Africans for it. It's probably going to lead to further isolation of South Africa, and poor South Africans are going to suffer most. So it was totally reckless. It was totally uncalled for. We have a system, a culture in South Africa that we solve our own problems. When apartheid had to end, when the Afrikaner nationalists and the black nationalists confronted each other, we did not run to Britain or Holland or America to say, come in and solve our problem. Mandela and de Klerk and their parties got together and sat around the table. It was a homemade peace. It was a homemade settlement. That's our culture. These people run overseas, and the small reassurance they have is that Trump says he will accept them as refugees. Well, that means they will never be able to come back. Nobody is going to go who has a good job or a farm. Nobody is going to go for refugee status. It is all totally ludicrous.
The party of the former South African president, Jacob Zuma, MK, they have filed charges of treason against AfriForum. What's your take on this? Do you think an act of treason has been performed in the course of the claims that AfriForum has been making?
No, I think that is rather ridiculous. It will not fly in our courts. We have a very well-established system of free speech and the rule of law. That's a bridge too far. I would call it unpatriotic and reckless, but not criminal treachery.
So what's the mood in South Africa now, especially in light of these discussions and the reaction of the top levels of the US government towards this debate in South Africa?
Two things. One is all of us are slightly scared of how Trump will hurt our economy. Already hundreds of thousands of people who are HIV positive cannot be helped, and they were helped by some of the USAID programs. We are scared that Trump is going to impose proper sanctions on us, maybe even cut us off the IMF and the World Bank. So we're scared of our fragile economy. The other point I want to make is this has been really bad for Afrikaners. Wherever I go in South Africa now, black people look at me and say, hey, you people, after all these years, after all the peace we made, is this how you repay us? So it's been bad for race relations, what AfriForum did and what Musk and Trump are doing. But it's up to people like me to stand up and say, we are not all like that. We are proper African South Africans.
Max Dupriya in South Africa. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now to a woman who stunned the world during the Paris Olympics 6 months ago. Egyptian fencer Nada Hafez went out in the last 16 of her event and then put up a post on Instagram confirming she had competed while 7 months pregnant. It made headline news the world over. Now, as a mom to a four-month-old baby girl, she's been talking to BBC Sport Africa's Nishat Lather about her experience and how she hopes to have inspired other expecting moms. Nishat has been telling me all about it. Right, Nishat, thank you for your time. This wasn't Nada Hafez's first Olympics, was it?
No, Charles, she'd actually competed at two previous Olympic Games, at Rio 2016 and then Tokyo 2020. She was actually a junior gymnast champion, but she'd got injured and then she took up fencing as a 12-year-old. And she comes from a family where sport is really important to them. She took to fencing really quickly. She rose through the ranks nationally in Egypt and then in Africa. And she carried on competing while studying medicine at university. So she now works as a clinical pathologist. And she's married to a cardiothoracic surgeon. So Paris 2024 was, in fact, her third Olympics, but of course, a very different Games because she was in the third trimester of her pregnancy, a pregnancy which very few people knew about. And she decided that just participating wouldn't be enough. She wanted to do something special for her and her baby.
I tried not to think that I'm pregnant. I have my excuse to not to win. No, I thought differently. I'm pregnant and I will win. And I did it. So I'm so proud of what I did because it's different and it's one of the best results in the female Egyptian Olympians. I'm a competitive person. So when it comes to the Olympics, I was thinking what I was thinking about my baby, that I want to be the Olympian and my baby to be an Olympian. So yeah, my baby motivated me for this.
And Charles, Hafez actually managed to beat a top 10 player, the American Elizabeth Tatakovsky, in her first match, which was a huge achievement. All that while 7 months pregnant.
And while she was on the fencing piste in Paris, very few people really knew she was pregnant, right?
That's right. She told me that she didn't tell her opponents because she said it would be unfair on them because, of course, fencing is a combat sport. You use swords and she didn't want them to be afraid or uncomfortable. She said she really only told the people who needed to know. So that was her mental coach and her doctor. She knew that there was no law or rule preventing her from competing in the Olympics. And I've actually spoken to the Egyptian Olympic Committee. They've told me that they have no problem with a pregnant woman competing as long as they are sure it is safe for her and her baby. So she'd got clearance from medical specialists to carry on fencing and competing. And she felt well, she felt safe and she felt good.
And then when she went out on the last 16 in Paris and put out that Instagram post revealing that she was 7 months pregnant, how did she cope with all the messages? Because this really made headlines across the globe.
Yeah, it absolutely did, Charles. Everyone was talking about it. She's not the first woman to compete at an Olympics pregnant, but I think it's the fact that she was quite far into her pregnancy. She was 7 months pregnant. Also, the optics of fencing, because it has a sword. But she discussed this with her doctor, the fact that fencers use touch when they compete. And also, the position of her legs was an issue, but her doctors determined that it was all safe. She says she simply wanted to be an example and an inspiration for women everywhere. And that's what motivated her to put up her post.
I was so happy, and I read all the messages from women, and actually not only women, there are young girls, and they told me, you inspired us so much, and we want to go to medical school, I want to continue in sports. And when I get a message from anyone telling me that I'm an example, I'm a role model, it's really big. It set my heart on fire, because that was what I'm working on for my whole life. And I'm still young. I'm 27. I'm aiming to do more. And I'm aiming to be a good example as a mom. So it's a feeling I can't even describe it.
And Charles, it was that feeling for her which justified her telling the world that she was pregnant.
Nishat, it's online. There were negative messages as well. How did she deal with that?
Well, she's actually very strong when you consider that people across the world were writing about her with opinions on whether or not she should have been competing, all quite personal stuff. The comments ranged from people speculating that she went to Paris to try and get French nationality, which she has rubbished, to her taking an Olympic spot away from others who were more deserving. So she then had to put up another post explaining she was fine to compete. And Hafez really needed strength of mind when coping with the online trolls.
My mom told me, don't be sad if you read anything bad. And I was like, no, never. I'm sure of what I did. I'm proud of what I did. I achieved something and it was very challenging. So I didn't understand what people are talking about, because some people, they're saying you can leave another place for another one to fence. And this is not an option because I'm qualified by my name. So I didn't take anyone's place, for example. I read the messages and then I understand that people, they don't know about the sport. They don't know about me, about my background, anything. And it's easy to put a comment on the post and run. You don't face me. Some people, they don't want to see a successful woman.
And Nishat, whether people agree with her competing at 7 months pregnant or not, it certainly really opened up discussions around the sport and pregnancy.
It really did, Charles, because Hafez, who's 27, is a doctor herself. Her husband is a doctor. He hails from a family of doctors. So she wasn't short of medical advice. They all supported her. She says she had the information and she was guided as well by how she felt, how her body felt. And it all worked out well for her because she is now a mum to four-month-old baby Zaina. She wanted to show what a woman's body is capable of, especially in pregnancy, as long as it is safe for mum and baby.
I was very proud that an Egyptian Arab woman can tell the world that your body can surprise you, that we have strength that you will never know about it. You just have to experience it. Sometimes you need to see an example in front of you to know that you can do it. Because maybe a pregnant woman, she's just afraid to move, she's afraid to do anything. And now she just tells herself, there's an Olympian woman that she competes at the Olympics while pregnant, so I can do whatever it is. And I wanted to give a message for all women that you don't have a disease. You're just a normal woman and you're pregnant.
And Charles, she is a new mum to a baby daughter. She's studying for her master's, so she has a lot on her plate for now. So she hasn't yet decided whether she'll try and qualify for the Los Angeles Olympics in 2028. But she's using her platform to speak up for women's rights, especially when it comes to areas like sport and, of course, pregnancy.
BBC Sport Africa's Nishat Ladha. Focus on Africa was produced by Patricia Whitehorn and Nyasha Michelle in London and Frenny Joey in Nairobi. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer in charge and Jack Graysmark, the technical producer. Our editors are Andrea Lombard and Alice Mudengi. Our sister podcast, Africa Daily, is also in Sierra Leone and explores whether technology and urban greening can cool Sierra Leone's scorching heat. I'm Charles Gitonga. Goodbye for now.